We're going to be looking at the Gospel of Luke, chapter 19, and the very first part of the chapter. Over the last few weeks, our theme has been that of evangelism, sharing the good news of the Gospel with the world. And we've learned a number of lessons from the Gospel of Luke along that theme. We looked at the parable of the sower, and we saw the different kinds of soils which those who want to spread the word will encounter as they do so. We studied how Jesus sent 70 of his followers out on a kind of field trip, discovering through experiential learning what evangelism was like firsthand, and learned some lessons from that. Last week and this week, we're looking at two particular case studies, observing Jesus himself doing the work of an evangelist, dealing with an individual who is seeking salvation in some way. Last week we looked at the rich ruler in Luke chapter 18, which is in many ways a sad story, because he's a man who comes to Jesus seeking, but seems to go away not having found. Today we look at a happier story, though a rather unexpected one. It's the story of Zacchaeus. Luke chapter 19 and the first 10 verses then. Jesus entered Jericho and was passing through. A man was there by the name of Zacchaeus. He was a chief tax collector and was wealthy. He wanted to see who Jesus was, but being a short man, he could not because of the crowd. So he ran ahead and climbed a sycamore fig tree to see him, since Jesus was coming that way. When Jesus reached the spot, he looked up and said to him, "Zacchaeus, come down immediately. I must stay at your house today." So he came down at once and welcomed him gladly. All the people saw this and began to mutter, "He has gone to be the guest of a sinner." But Zacchaeus stood up and said to the Lord, "Look, Lord, here and now I give half of my possessions to the poor, and if I have cheated anybody out of anything, I will pay back four times the amount." Jesus said to him, "Today salvation has come to this house, because this man too is a son of Abraham. For the Son of Man came to seek and to save what was lost." "He can't help it, you know," she said, shaking her head. "He's just like his father." "That's right," nodded the other woman. "He'll never change. My Harry's known him since he was a kid, says he's always been like it. His brothers are all the same, too." I never did discover who exactly they were talking about, because at that point, our underground train rolled into the station, and in the tide of passengers going in and out, I was no longer compressed by a rush hour intimacy into a position where I could overhear their conversation, at least not without appearing unduly nosy. But I had heard enough to depress me. Who was this pathetic victim of his genetic inheritance, I wondered? Some cretinous 10-year-old condemned to an abysmally low academic achievement by his parents' inadequate IQ? Some delinquent 18-year-old doomed to an irremediable life of law-breaking by his family's criminal record? Some 40-year-old alcoholic, perhaps, rendered incapable of sobriety by the generations of addiction that preceded his birth? Possibilities were legion. I could only guess. But whoever he was, I felt very sorry for him. Sorry about the handicap, which, if my informants were correct, a cruel providence had lumbered him with. But sorry more about the tone of helplessness and resignation with which those two ladies had discussed his sad case. Was this poor fellow's future so rigidly determined by the past? Was it really so impossible that he should turn out differently from the rest of his family? Do our genes control our destiny with quite so inflexible a fatalism? I don't believe they do. And more to the point this morning, I don't think Jesus believes they do either. The whole thing about Jesus is that he believed it was possible for people to change. That's why he went around all the time saying, repent. Because that's what that word means. Change. He didn't say it was always easy to change. For without question, human behavior is immensely influenced by our backgrounds in all kinds of ways. We are the victims of all kinds of pressures and forces. But nobody is hopelessly changed to the past by the shackles of genetic determinism or social conditioning or anything else like that. That's what Jesus was getting at when he told a man, you must be born again. Such a thing is possible. People can change. People do change. And sometimes it's the most unexpected and unlikely people that prove the point. Take Zacchaeus, for instance. Now, if ever there was a case of genetic handicap, it's him. For we're told he was a short man. Now, there's nothing anybody can do about that, is there? He can hardly be blamed for his DNA code reading out physical height limited. He's what they call these days upwardly challenged. And did the other children laugh at him at school as a result, I wonder? Did they call him a titch or a shrimp or a runt? Did they mock his feeble efforts at sport? Wouldn't be surprising if they did, would it? Because kids are cruel. Did his parents favor his taller and more impressive brothers and sisters? Did he feel rejected by them, unwanted by them, inferior, unloved? Again, it wouldn't be surprising because parents can be pretty cruel too. And did Zacchaeus, as he grew up, I wonder, develop an angry resentment in defense of his humiliated ego? Did he vow he would get his own back on those spiteful kids at school? Or those negligent parents? Or those more favored siblings? Did he swear he would prove to them that pint-sized though he was no failure? He would show them a thing or two. He would make them sorry for all the misery they'd inflicted on him. Again, it wouldn't be surprising, would it? For Zacchaeus would not be the first dynamic dwarf in history, motivated, driven by that kind of inner experience. And there has to be some explanation for his antisocial choice of career, after all. We're told he was a tax collector. Now, I suppose that working for the Inland Revenue carries a hint of unpopularity, even in our society today. But it's nothing compared to what it was like in those days. You see, in the first century in Judea, the stigma associated with the occupation of being a tax collector was sufficient to make a man a complete outcast. For you see, the country was in the grip of foreign imperialism. The tax which Zacchaeus collected went into the Roman treasury. It paid the Roman army that kept the detested Roman government in place, which these fiercely nationalistic Jews resented so much. To pay tax at all was regarded by many Jews as treacherous. To accept employment as the stooge who was called upon to collect these taxes, that certainly was treacherous. So pious Jews treated tax collectors as the scum of the earth. Their contact with Gentiles made them unclean anyway, but their collaboration with the Romans made them utterly contemptible. And as if that wasn't enough, it was a well-known fact that 99% of these tax collectors were as crooked as they come. Well, it stood to reason, didn't it? Nobody was going to take the job unless there was money in it. There was nothing else in such a career. So the Romans cast a blind eye at the extortion with menaces which many of these tax collectors engaged in to increase their income. The protection rackets they ran. Zacchaeus, we're told, was a chief tax collector, so clearly he had risen very high in this disreputable profession. What's more, his tax district was Jericho, which we know was a major customs port on the main road east from Jerusalem. There could be rich pickings from the excise duty payable in a town like that. So little wonder that Luke tells us with emphatic brevity, he was wealthy. You bet he was. Still, there was something in spite of all his antisocial and money-grubbing and criminal traits, there was something rather winning about Zacchaeus, wasn't there? Like Fagin in Oliver Twist, there's a kind of unexpected humour in the man, a touch of rather charming eccentricity. And it surfaces very obviously when Jesus, only a matter of days now away from his arrest and trial, passes through Jericho en route to Jerusalem. He wanted to see who Jesus was, we're told. But being a short man, he couldn't because of the crowd. So he ran ahead and climbed the sycamore fig tree to see him. There has to be something hilariously incongruous about this, you see. This eminent and affluent member of the civil service, this bureaucrat whom everybody's supposed to pretend they respect, even if they secretly loathe them, shinning up a tree to see over the heads of the milling crowds. It would be a bit like some senior officer in a bank in England climbing a lamppost in order to watch the Lord Mayor go by. You just don't expect people with this station in life to do things like that. Certainly not in Jewish society. He was risking ridicule. You can just imagine what the local youth were shouting up at him as they saw him trying to scramble up this tree. Want a leg up, Zacchaeus? So what was it motivated him to do such an extraordinary thing? Curiosity, I suppose. Luke tells us he wanted to see who Jesus was. He must have heard rumours about this rabbi who worked miracles. But there were no newspaper photographs in those days, of course. He wanted to find out what he looked like. Encounters with Jesus quite often begin with curiosity. There's something different about that Christian who works in the next room to me. I must ask him over coffee what it's all about. This Bible seems a very unusual book. I must study it a bit more closely. That church seems to have a lot of people going in and out every Sunday. I must find out what goes on there. That's often how it begins. Curiosity. In fact, it's rather regrettable that there isn't more curiosity than that around. There's many a Zacchaeus, it seems to me, who is too busy to climb trees. Many a Zacchaeus who's so consumed with his daily routine, he hasn't got the time. Too much work at the office, maybe next week. No, he can't be bothered to climb a tree. There's many a Zacchaeus who is too cynical. Miracles indeed, load of conjuring tricks more like. There's got to be a perfectly ordinary scientific explanation. It's not worth the trouble to investigate, no. He won't be climbing any trees either. Far too many of us shut the door on Jesus by means of that kind of dismissive defense mechanism. Unwilling even to be a little curious about him. But one does have to admit, if Zacchaeus had known where his periscopic curiosity would have led him, he might have thought twice about it. See what happens. When Jesus reached the spot, he looked up and said to him, "Zacchaeus, come down immediately. I must stay at your house today." Masses of questions press themselves upon our minds, don't they? How did Jesus know his name? How did Jesus know he was there? Why, of all people in Jericho, does he pick on him? For pick on him he did. Jesus waits for no polite invitation from Zacchaeus here. He doesn't wait, as he did in the case of the rich ruler, for this man to run up and kneel at his feet. He doesn't even ask permission. He doesn't even give him a choice. His tone is imperative, peremptory, uncompromising. "Come down immediately, Zacchaeus," he says. "I must stay at your home today." But that's the uncanny thing about Jesus, isn't it? He has this disturbing knack of turning our curiosity into encounter. We think we're investigating him. We climb the pole of our academic research so that we can view him with detached objectivity. Then he goes and turns the tables on us, and we who thought we were the examiner find we're under examination ourselves. We think we were safe. We thought we were concealed among the leaves, on the fringe of the congregation. "Nobody can see me here. It's so nice coming to Eden. It's a good anonymous place, you know. No one talks to you if you don't want to be talked to." We can play the role of a spiritual voyeur, getting a taste, a little hint of what religion's all about, without having to take the risk of a real relationship with God or anything mind-blowing like that. But somehow his eyes penetrate our hiding place. The would-be spectator finds himself propelled into embarrassing conspicuousness. Can't you imagine how startled Zacchaeus was? Can't you imagine the blush on his cheeks? "He's not coming over here, is he? He's not looking up at me, is he? Hello, Zacchaeus." Can't you imagine it? "It's not you who is waiting there to see me. It's I who am waiting to see you." This, of course, played out on the stage of this story, is what the Apostle Paul calls divine election. A Jesus who knows our name, though we've never met him before. Who seems to ignore the rest of the people, all the crowd surrounding us, who summons us personally, sovereignly, almost irresistibly by our own name. And demands a response. So he came down at once and welcomed him gladly. Had Zacchaeus been secretly longing for an opportunity to meet Jesus? Perhaps it was more than curiosity that took him up into that tree. Perhaps there had been growing in this wealthy but surely rather unhappy man, perhaps there had been growing in him an increasing burden of self-loathing, a growing regret at his self-imposed loneliness, a pensive longing for the chance to begin again. Many people do harbour such private yearnings, because there are so many one-way streets in our lives, aren't there? You make a mistake, and there's no reversing it. You're stuck with the consequences. A broken marriage, a failed exam, a lost reputation, a prison sentence. You don't realize it, of course, when you're young, but everything, though it seems so fluid and so unconstrained in youth, everything you do, every decision you make or fail to make, actually is constructing a rut for you, in which your life ever after will be forced to run. "Stop the World, I Want to Get Off." That was the title of a West End musical about 20 years ago, I suppose. But unfortunately, as you get older, the world accelerates rather than diminishes its pace. Getting off becomes harder and harder, doesn't it? No, there's no possibility of change. I'd love to change, of course. I can see a better way, maybe, and even approve it. But the moving finger has writ, and having writ, moved on. Or says John Clare in one of his essays, if life had a second edition, I would correct the proofs. But unfortunately, we only get one stab at this living business. Yet perhaps it was more than curiosity then that moved Zacchaeus to want to see Jesus. Perhaps he'd heard what he had done for other tax collectors, how he had rehabilitated their ruined lives, even making old Matthew in the tax district of Galilee one of his own disciples. Maybe Zacchaeus had heard about that. Perhaps Zacchaeus dared to hope in some wild, half-formed, wishful thinking. But just maybe, Jesus could do the same for him. If he had entertained such thoughts, it would help to explain the alacrity of his response, wouldn't it? And the exuberance of it. He comes down at once. He welcomes him gladly. If there is embarrassment there, it is quickly swamped by jubilation. His dream has come true. It can't be mere exhibitionism on the part of some impulsive or extrovert personality, can it? His later public statement surely makes that plain. No, this is a transformed life. Look, Lord, he says, here and now I give half of my possessions to the poor. And if I've cheated anybody out of anything, I will pay back four times the amount. You see, it is the miracle. We began by saying was surely impossible. This greedy egotist has discovered charity. This criminal extortioner has discovered penitence. There's not even anything hypothetical about his renunciation of his ill-gotten gains, unlike some who are content only to be charitable in their wills. Zacchaeus pledges largesse at that very moment. You can almost hear the queue beginning to form at his door, can't you? Indeed, he finds it hard to believe it himself, so it seems. Look, Lord, he says. The original has a tone of wonder, literally, behold. It's a tone almost of bewilderment. Can this really be me, he's saying to himself. Am I really doing this? It can't be true. Look, Lord. Here and now I give half of my possessions to the poor, and if I've cheated anybody out of anything, I will pay back four times the amount. His response, of course, is in very sharp contrast, and I suspect deliberate contrast, to the response of that rich ruler we talked about last week. Sell what you have and give to the poor, Jesus had said to him, and you'll have treasure in heaven. But he went away sad because he had great wealth. How hard it is for a rich man to enter the kingdom. That was Jesus' comment, wasn't it? Oh yes, hard. But as this story reminds us, not impossible. For nothing is impossible with God. No human heart is frozen so hard in its self-centeredness that he cannot defrost it. And Zacchaeus is the proof. Some of us here are, shall we say, comfortably off. Don't be encouraged by the story of Zacchaeus. The kingdom of God is for you too. Unlike Karl Marx, Jesus does not limit entry to his new society, to the working classes and the peasantry. Now, your wealth can be a spiritual hindrance to you, as it was to that rich young man, but it need not be a spiritual disqualification. What Jesus insists is, if you want to be different, your attitude to money has to change. Acquisitiveness must be replaced by generosity. Look, here and now I give half my possessions to the poor. And if our wealth has in any respect whatsoever been derived from injustice, then there must be restitution. compensation. If I've cheated anybody out of anything, I will pay back four times the amount. It is the mark, you see, of a changed life that is ready to make such gestures. Maybe the hindrance in our life is not money, as it was in the case of that rich ruler and of Zacchaeus. Maybe that isn't the focus of our sin. Maybe it isn't financial greed that ruins us. Maybe it's sexual lust or academic pride. All sorts of passions and drives can ruin a man or woman. It is the mark of a transformed life that it is ready to make big gestures of renunciation to signal the change that has come about. Human nature is intractable. It takes nothing less than the power that moves mountains to change the contours of a human personality. But it can be done. As the great theologian Augustine put it, he who made us can remake us. In fact, he's the only one who can. People can change. People do change. When education and psychotherapy and counseling and prison and whatever else society tries to do to work that change, when all those things have failed, when countless personal resolutions have been made and broken, when the world shrugs its shoulders and says he can't help it, he's just like his father, he'll always be the same. People do change. Jesus changes them. See how he interprets what has happened to Zacchaeus. Today, he says, salvation has come to this house. Because this man too is a son of Abraham. The Son of Man came to seek and to save what was lost. There's an agenda underneath those comments. The Jews in Jesus' day were looking forward to salvation. They were looking forward to the day when the Messiah would come and reward them. But most of them believed his reward would be for the righteous people. For the people who had not collaborated with pagan Romans. The people who had maintained the law of Moses in purity. Those would be the people who, when salvation came, would find themselves rewarded. The people who'd gone the way of the world. The people who'd collaborated with the Romans. The sinners. They would find themselves in the lake of fire. That was the picture people had in their minds of salvation. It was for really a rather restricted company. Jesus knew it would not be like that. Jesus knew they were completely wrong. When he overheard them complaining, he's gone to be the guest of a sinner. He knew he had to say something to debunk their completely wrong ideas of the messianic kingdom and the salvation of which it spoke. Today, he says, salvation has come to this house. For this man you all detest, this man you take for granted is doomed to hell, this man is a son of the covenant, a son of Abraham, a child of God. What you've got to realize is, the Son of Man has come into this world to seek and to save lost people like him. He's completely overturning, you see, their false ideas. Maybe he has to completely overturn our ideas too. Salvation is not a reward for the super spiritual. My kingdom, he says, is not an exclusive club for Jewish nationalists. My kingdom is a gift to anybody, absolutely anybody, who is willing to change. today salvation has come to this house. So what do we learn from the story of Zacchaeus? Well, we learn, first of all, those of us who are Christians here, a very important lesson about evangelism, to add to all the other lessons about evangelism we have acquired in the last 4 weeks. We learn how important it is to believe that people can change. How important it is not to write anybody off, no matter how unlikely you think they are, as a potential convert for the kingdom of God. What was it, do you think, that was responsible for this dramatic change in Zacchaeus' behavior? What do you attribute it to? Well, on a human level, I have to say, there can be little doubt that the condescension of Jesus in inviting himself as a dinner guest at this man's house must have made a very powerful impression on him, don't you think? When was the last time a rabbi had sat at table with Zacchaeus, I wonder? Had such a thing ever happened in living memory? No, respectable people shunned his company. They are scandalized that Jesus didn't do the same. But then you see, that's Jesus all over. Sin for him is not some moral contagion which you catch as a result of being in a defiling environment. That's where the self-righteous Jews of his day were so different from him. They thought of sin in that kind of way, that you could catch it from the world just by close proximity. No, Jesus saw sin as a corruption inside the human heart. And because that's where the focus of our sinfulness, of our moral failures is, only those of us who are willing to get close enough to sinners, to speak to their hearts, to touch their hearts, can have any chance of changing those hearts. It's a powerful lesson, isn't it? Oh, I'm not saying there is no moral danger in bad company. Don't run away with that idea. But if you and I are going to be evangelists, there is no way any of us will ever be used in the conversion of anyone if we treat them like spiritual lepers, kept at arm's length, lest we be contaminated by their worldliness and moral defilement. It's quite clear to me that Zacchaeus was profoundly moved by the willingness of this great man Jesus to defy the sanctimonious outrage of the crowd and identify himself as his personal friend. Even to the extent of sharing his hospitality. Of all the homes he could stay in Jericho, he picks Zacchaeus and does so in the most glaring and public way he can. Such graciousness, you see, breaks through the psychological defenses of the man in a way nothing else could. All those inferiority feelings about his height, all those guilt feelings about his lifestyle, all that resentment towards his fellow countrymen, it melts away in the unexpected, the disarming warmth of this total stranger's loving acceptance of him. You would be surprised how many people there are out there in your neighborhood, in this city, who would respond quite unexpectedly, in just the way Zacchaeus does, at a similar gesture from you. You would be amazed. You would be amazed how full this city is of lonely, love-hungry men and women. And it is the task of the church to seek and to save them. It is to the shame of the church that we are found too often murmuring among the respectable, when we should be dining with the tax collectors. But what about those of us here who aren't Christians this morning? I know there are some. Is there a lesson here for you? Sure there is. There's something you have got to take on board. Maybe you're here as a spectator. That's how you see yourself. You don't belong to this Christian group. You're curious about Jesus, but uninvolved with him. Just like Zacchaeus, perhaps you feel a little out of place among religious people. Perhaps you feel a little guilt-ridden in a place like this, of a little unworthy to be here, maybe. Maybe your lifestyle is an embarrassment to you amongst all these so-called respectable churchgoers. Maybe you defend against that by entertaining a sneaking contempt in your attitude towards all these holy Joes surrounding you singing hymns. Is it possible, do you think, that Jesus is calling you down from your tree? Calling you by name. Can you hear him? Could it be, do you think, he wants to demonstrate to you, just as he did to Zacchaeus, that his kingdom is not a heavenly reward for some pious elite? No. His kingdom is the power to change. It is the determination that seeks and saves lost people. He's not asking you, you see, to conform to some middle-class evangelical stereotype. He's not demanding that you start mouthing conventional Christian platitudes. But he is calling you to himself, isn't he? Calling you to discover a whole new identity among the true people of God. He's longing to pronounce that salvation has come to your house, to your marriage, to your family, to your job, to your lifestyle. They're never going to be the same again, because you too are a member of the people of God, a son of Abraham, a child of God. Why do you hesitate? Why do you still cling to the branches of the tree? Why do you still shrink back into the concealment of its leaves? Can't you hear the urgency of his voice? He isn't just inviting you now. He's commanding you. Zacchaeus, come down immediately. I must stay at your house today. Why today? Why does it have to be today, Jesus? Why? Because he's only passing through Jericho. Tomorrow he dies in Jerusalem. If you don't come down today, maybe you won't come down at all. Let's pray together.